happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
Oh, when he wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios, New York City. And I welcome you from all over the world and all the different syndicated stations. We take on the issues that empower us, always about health and healing, living a longer life, but also looking honestly at the issues that cause us stress, distress, that causes us problems, and looking for the positive solution. Today, for example, we're going to look at cancer drugs found to promote cancer growth. Then we're going to look at how cornflakes and white bread, which a lot of Americans eat, up your risk of heart attacks. And that was from Tel Aviv University. And how a high-fat, high-sugar diet, which is common, alters your brain receptors, and that's from Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, and drugs don't work, from The Guardian. The number of people on antidepressants is soaring, but we are not getting better. They're not working. Why not? I'll explain, and a lot more on health and healing. We always try to cite the source of the information so that you can have confidence that it's from qualified, independent, good gold standards. Then, our guest in the second part of our program from Washington, D.C. is Winona Hotter. She is the executive director of Food and Water Watch, and we're going to talk about America's fracopoly. Hydrofracking dangers everyone. So why it continues to be popular, we'll explore, we'll explain. Then I was going through some archives, and these were about to be sent off to storage. I hadn't looked in these in a long time, but I had some time on Sunday coming back from our run in the park with the runners and walkers. By the way, a great group of people were posting photographs of each Sunday's group, and they're just coming out to get into shape. And already some of them are up to doing 12 miles on Sundays. Anyhow, everyone's invited. It's 9 o'clock at 5th Avenue and 90th Street. We get there early. We get there at 7 because we do our 12 miles before people come. But people are losing weight. They're feeling better. And so I got home, and I decided, let me go through these boxes. Lo and behold, I found a letter. Found a lot of letters. I'm going to read some. And one is from one of the oldest living actresses, just celebrated her 100th birthday. And here, I didn't even know I had this. I'll read it to you, and it's relevant today. And then some people who decided to change their lives. This is back in the 1980s, others in the 1990s. And what happened because they changed their dietary habits. Then also today, I'm going to take a look at Julian Skeet from Huffington Post, wrote a short piece about the truth about terror, and it isn't complicated. Then a very important piece by a man I have an enormous amount of respect for. In fact, he was recently on this program, a very rare occasion that he ever is interviewed in the United States, John Pilger from Global Research, why the rise of fascism is again the issue. This is extraordinarily relevant, especially when we look at all the terrorist activity and our misbegotten responses to it and not understanding it. Also today, Lawrence O'Donnell of MSNBC actually makes a very important statement about Rand Paul. I'll play you what Rand Paul had to say, and if time permits, I'd like your feedback on it. It's highly relevant. Also, wouldn't it be nice if we had legislators who are willing to go on record about how corrupt our banking system is, and the bankers should be held accountable. This Godfrey Bloom at the European Union goes on record. It's a short piece, but oh, I'd love to hear this in the United States. Also, Seeds of Death. That was the title of a documentary I produced last 2 years ago. Well, Monsanto has been producing seeds in Iraq. This is a story you've never heard. This is really relevant. And this is a whole new reason to understand why Paul Bremer and the neocons wanted control of everything in Iraq. This is important. And it's brand new. So these are the things we're going to share today. As you see, we have a lot to go into. And we always begin with health and healing. And by the way, if you want to watch today's program, go to Ustream and then seek Gary Noll. Just search for Gary Noll, the Ustream channel. Search for Gary Noll and you can watch. And if you're listening, and by the way, we just set a record for the people listening over the telephone. And it's simple. A lot of people travel. They can't always be by a terrestrial land-based station. But maybe they're not internet savvy or have access to an internet. But everyone has access to a portable listening device. And so they tune in at noon and listen. In fact, when I came to work today, the person said, "Aren't you Gary Noll?" She said, "Hey, I got right here every day. I turn this on. And I put the speakers on, and if people want to hear what you're saying, if not, I listen through the earplugs myself." So you can hear Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, 5 days a week, and on Tuesday at 7 p.m. as well for the Progressive Commentary. And you can listen over any listening device, a telephone. Let me give you the number, 712-775-6850, 712-775-6850. Last Tuesday, when our local sister station, where I've been for 40 years, had a technical glitch and our show wasn't on, we hit a record, 78,600 plus minute listens. That's a record of any radio program in America. So a lot of people are using it. High fat, it's bad. High sugar is actually worse. Why? Because according to this new research from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, sugar and fat can lead to brain receptors being maladapted. The new research results from a study that was presented at the Society for Study of Ingested Behavior, and they're saying that when you're eating all this sugar and fat, your brain's not working the way it should. And part of the reason is that we don't understand and only are now beginning to appreciate the opiate receptors in the areas of the brain that control food intake. And opiates are a family of chemicals with actions similar to those of morphine or heroin. And opiates exist naturally in the brain, and they've been linked to feeling of pleasure, even euphoria. Quote from the study, "These results are interesting because we saw changes in opiate receptors genes expression in a brain area that controls how much we eat during a meal." And what that means is these findings suggest that when you're eating food or even binging on foods, in part it's because it's impacting the opiates in your brain. And so let me just put this in even simpler language. Let's say that you're stressed or you're not having a good day. So you want some comfort food. Now, maybe your comfort food's a pizza, or maybe it's ice cream, or maybe it's a bag of pretzels. part of what's happening is you're actually stimulating these opiate receptors in the brain. And so the more you eat, the better you feel. And the better you feel, then the more you want to feel. And so you really can't control yourself. So when you hear people saying how much they've eaten of something, you think, wow, that's a lot. And you're thinking, well, I wouldn't eat that much. Well, because maybe you're not eating something to satisfy some emotional issue. Now, here's the good news. When you start cutting back on these opiate receptor stimulating foods, and you start to exercise, going for a power walk in the morning, no more than a half hour, you're stimulating endorphins. And the endorphins have an effect that is very similar. It also stimulates these opiate receptors. And as a result, you feel good. And that's why doing a good workout, biking, exercising, you have that exercise high. You feel very peaceful. Interesting, because I live in New York City. I live on the Upper West Side. I have since the day I've arrived in New York City. And yes, I live on a ranch, an organic ranch, and I also do animal rescue. And I love rescuing and helping animals get back to health, both emotionally and physically, and then finding homes for them or finding that they can be let go in the wild to return to nature. And there's a certain satisfaction. You feel a pleasure when something is done. So when I'm going for a walk at night, which I frequently do, I'm walking by gyms, and they're packed. And we're talking about late-night gyms. In fact, there's a whole lot of gyms staying open till wee early hours in the morning. And you see all those exercise pieces of equipment. People are just working out on them. Why? Because there's no time during the day for them to work out. So I began to talk with some people, and I found out that when they exercise at night, they don't have a problem going to sleep. They feel at ease. They feel relaxed. They feel meditative. Even though the exercise will stimulate their blood sugar and stimulate an anabolic reaction, that can subside within an hour. So if they exercise at 10 o'clock, it's easier for them to go to sleep at 11 o'clock. So one way or the other, much better to exercise to get the brain receptors feeling good than to eat sugary, fatty foods, because that's going to give you that temporary high. But just like heroin or cocaine or methamphetamine or opium, you'll feel high, you'll feel peaceful, you'll feel blissed, you'll feel energized, but then it becomes addictive. And then it's easier to take the drug than to deal with issues. Talking about drugs, we know that most drugs don't work. In fact, every day, all day, I'm working in post-production on films that I spent the last 5 months traveling on the road, plus another 6 months working. So these are anywhere from 1 to 3 years of work, and they're all coming to a conclusion. But the conclusions, when you sit there with your editor and you say, yes, that goes in, no, that doesn't. And this morning in one film, there are three, and they'll be premiered in the late summer or early fall, I'm selecting comments from board-certified oncologists, cardiologists, neurologists, gastroenterologists, and they're all saying the same thing. I'm not giving any drugs, and I'm getting complete reversal, cures for diabetes, heart disease, atherosclerosis, cancers, obesity, one disease after another. Not improvements, cures. And they all had something in common. The doctors are also all vegans, and they help their own health conditions, and then went from helping themselves to helping their patients. And they know it works. Do the drugs work? No. The drugs don't cure anything. Here's the latest from The Guardian. They talk about the number of people on antidepressants is increasing rapidly, we may be more miserable, quote, but let's swap the pills for support and care. And that is what they're saying. They found that the study, quote, was deeply disturbing, because what they found is that we're taking all these pills because we're under financial distress, other things are happening in our lives, and the antidepressants, though they were increasing their use, they're not helping us resolve any of our issues, and they're not even working. Now, I thought that was important, because the people listening to this radio program know that over a period of 20 years, there have been several classic studies, really well done, that show that antidepressants that are very toxic, that have side effects for the very condition that you're taking. So if you take an antidepressant, one of the side effects is depression. And if you take an anti-anxiety medication, the side effect is anxiety. And if you take a statin, one of the side effects is heart disease. And if you take an aspirin or something that thins your blood to prevent a stroke, the side effect is heart attacks. So people are not aware of how bad most drugs are for chronic conditions. And we have found that the best treatment for depression is and anxiety are having qualified people take a humanistic approach to help you understand the options you have of coping and dealing and transcending the crisis that leaves you depressed or anxious. Also, we know that our diet can make an enormous difference in our moods and emotions. And we also know how we can stimulate brain healing with the B complex, with phosphatidylserine, with alpha lipoic acid, with glycerol phosphorylcholine. These are nutrients, along with ginkgo biloba, that directly positively impact brain chemistry in a good way. So we know that we can help people with St. John's wort who have depression and anxiety. We know that a person who's anxious generally has upset digestion. We know that marshmallow, the herb, along with fennel, easy to get, put it in your salads, your soups, your brown rice. Anise, also easy to get, inexpensive. Cinnamon and aloe vera all help with digestion. We know that having bromelain, which is the core, the pithy part of pineapple, that helps if you have digestive problems. We know that eating papaya, including those black little seeds, are great for digestion. So when we have tens of millions of Americans who have anxiety problems, depression problems, they also all have digestive problems. If you have digestive problems, you're not digesting your food. If you're not digesting your food, it means that you're not getting the absorption and utilization of the nutrients, which is the whole purpose of why you're eating. We think the reason we should eat is because we're hungry, and we have certain taste preferences and mouthfeels, and we love a certain aroma. Those are all important, but the real reason we eat is because we become what we eat. So we have to be conscious of that. But if you have emotional problems, the likelihood is you have digestive problems. If you have digestive problems and you have elimination problems and you have itises in your intestine, you have spastic colon, Crohn's disease, constipation, diarrhea, diverticulitis. So you have all those maladies, pro-inflammatory maladies. So what are you going to do? You're going to eat something that contributes to it. You're going to drink alcohol, drink coffee. There's something that if it was invented today for the first time, it'd be banned as toxic. But instead, we take it and then wonder why we have GERD and other gastric reflux, where the hydrochloric acid splashes back into the esophagus, and we end up with inflammation of the esophagus, or heartburn. You actually don't have the heart burning. You have the esophagus burning from the hydrochloric acid in the stomach when you drink coffee. So if we had a juice that we could take, like a green juice, or pineapple juice, or pineapple papaya juice, or apple, pineapple, papaya juice, that soothes it. You want to heal that? Cabbage juice. Cabbage juice is the best way to heal ulcers, best way to heal Helicobacter. And then you put aloe vera into that. You're healing the intestine. You're healing the stomach. You're healing the esophagus. And you're doing good. then take some digestive enzymes and probiotic. You're then recolonizing the bacteria. So even though you might have been stressed or depressed, by taking the right herbs, taking the right nutrients, calcium, magnesium, that's calming you down. L-theanine is helping you sleep at night. And then your digestion improves, your mood improves, you begin to exercise, you begin to lose weight, you get some good holistic humanistic counseling, and there's no reason that we have to take any more of these extraordinarily dangerous, useless drugs. And talking about dangerous and useless, in my opinion, cornflakes and white bread. Why? According to this study from the Shackler School of Medicine, and also Sheba Medical Center, they say, quote, exactly how cornflakes and white bread and French fries and other high-carb foods increase the risk of heart problems has now been shown by Tel Aviv University researchers. They found that foods with a high glycemic index and distended brachial arteries for several hours. High glycemic index meaning they convert to sugar. So the more refined a carbohydrate, the quicker it's going to become sugar, and that is going to cause problems with your arteries, and that's what they found here. So stay away from these and reduce the risk of heart attack. And finally, this is new research that showed that cancer drug found to promote tumor growth, from David Gutierrez, Natural News, quote, a new cancer drug actually promotes cancer tumor growth even at lower doses, according to a study conducted by researchers at the Institute for Cancer published in Nature Medicine, a peer-reviewed journal. This means that as the body removes large doses of the drug from its system, leaving behind successfully smaller doses, the cancer-promoting characteristics of the drug kick in. Quote, we've got evidence now that low doses can enhance tumor growth. So there is no benefit of giving high dose, which then drops, and then a high dose again, end quote. So let me spell the drug, CILENGITIDE. It's an anti-angiogenous drug in the same class of the anti-cancer drugs Avastin and Sutent. So one more reason why it shouldn't be on the market, in my opinion. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. I'm going to share now two separate commentaries. One short, one's a little longer, and you'll see why I'm sharing these in a few moments. The first is from the Huffington Post, from Jillian Skeet, and it's entitled The Truth About Terror Isn't That Complicated. It's very short. Like all Westerners, I watched in horror at the terror that was unleashed across Paris. But my horror quickly turned to frustration when, immediately in the aftermath, Western leaders took advantage of the situation to reinforce a false narrative and to justify the very policies that have brought us to such a crisis. Within hours of the attack, U.S. President Barack Obama proclaimed, quote, this is an attack on all of humanity and the universal values that we share. Comments like this are intended to portray those in the West as innocent victims of people determined to destroy honorable values. In truth, Western nations have been the perpetrators of state-sponsored terror that has been destroying country after country and the lives of millions of people. In 1999, I traveled to Baghdad and witnessed firsthand the anguish, death, and squalor brought on by the 1991 Gulf War, and years of crushing sanctions that killed more than 500,000 Iraqi children under the age of five. Walking the streets of Baghdad, seeing malnourished children begging in the streets, visiting hospitals with no medicine, and their water contaminated with raw sewage, I was overwhelmed by the cruelty deliberately inflicted upon the innocent people. For the first time in my life, I understood the rage, the helplessness, the hopelessness that fuels terrorism. Iraq would endure four more years of sanctions and a second disastrous war. Yet in my 1999 diary, I prophetically wrote, "What kind of future relationship will we have with an entire generation of Iraqis who have suffered such brutality at our hands? Iraq is not a nation of terrorists, but through our actions we have planted the seeds of extremism and hatred that could make it such in the future. Terrorism is not about unfounded hatred of freedom and democracy or religious extremism. It is about repression and exploitation of the powerless by the powerful. It is about the pain and anguish on a scale rarely, if ever, seen by most of us." End quote. The Gulf War occurred in 1991, and according to the UN Finnish envoy, Martti Ahtisaari, who was sent to assess the war damage, one of the wealthiest countries in the Middle East, with a strong, well-educated middle class, sustained nearly apocalyptic damage and was bombed back into the pre-industrial state. The water treatment system was deliberately targeted at the outset of the war in violation of the Convention on Genocide by Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, and sanctions were used to ensure that chlorine could not be imported and the system could not be repaired. By the way, my comment about Bill and Hillary Clinton are mine, not the author's, but that's who caused that. And I actually had the documents under Freedom of Information Act proving that the Defense Department did this intentionally. And that means it went against all war crimes. Quote, "The Iraqi people had not chosen Saddam Hussein as their leader, and they had no democratic mechanism to remove him so that sanctions can be lifted. Yet even the youngest among them were being punished with their lives. Those of us who tried to sound the alarm about the genocide that was taking place were largely ignored. Two United Nations humanitarian aid coordinators appointed to oversee the sanctions program responsible for such death and suffering, Dennis Halliday and Hans van Sponeck, resigned in protest, yet Western policy pressed on. What Western media coverage existed usually diverted attention away from the real issues and instead played games over the number of actual dead in Iraq, or deflected blame to Saddam Hussein despite the fact that the country had an excellent health care system and a relatively low child mortality rate prior to the war and sanctions. We must learn that we cannot brutalize people like this and then expect them to engage with us as global partners. It simply doesn't work that way. It is time for Western leaders to admit that their policies are bankrupt and have been for decades. Tragically, it is ordinary people on both sides who suffer and pay the price. The refugees fleeing war, violence, and terror in Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere are victims of the same policies that are now bringing terror and insecurity to our own shores. Our governments do not want us to understand that wittingly or unwittingly, they created the conditions for the rise of ISIS, and they did so through exactly the same disastrous policies they now claim are the only way to destroy it." That's one commentary. I thought that was well said. This is from Global Research, from John Pilger. And he is, by the way, just one of the most brilliant people on the planet. "The recent 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz was a reminder of the great crime of fascism, whose Nazi grouping is embedded in our consciousness. Fascism is preserved as history, as flickering footage of goose-stepping black shirts, their criminality terrible and clear, yet in the same liberal societies whose war-making elites urge us never to forget, the accelerating dangers of a modern kind of fascism is suppressed, for it is their fascism. To initiate a war of aggression, said the Nuremberg Tribunal judges in 1946, quote, it is not only an international crime, it is the supreme international crime, differing only from other war crimes, and that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole, end quote. Had the Nazis not invaded Europe, Auschwitz and the Holocaust would not have happened. Had the United States and its satellites not instigated their war of aggression in Iraq in 2003, almost 1 million people would be alive today, and the Islamic State, or ISIS, would not have us in thrall to its savagery. They are the progeny of modern fascism, weaned by the bombs, the bloodbaths, and the lies that are the surreal theater known as news. Like the fascism of the 1930s and 40s, big lies are delivered with the precision of a metronome, thanks to an omnipresent repetitive media and its violent censorship by omission. Take the catastrophic conditions in Libya. In 2011, NATO launched 9,700 strike sorties against Libya, of which more than a third were aimed at civilian targets. Uranium warheads were used. The cities of Misrata and Sirte were carpet bombed. The Red Cross identified mass graves, and UNICEF reported, quote, most of the children killed were under the age of 10. The public sodomizing of the Libyan president, Muammar Gaddafi, with a, quote, rebel bayonet, was greeted by the then U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton with the words, we came, we saw, he died. Then she cackled. His murder, like the destruction of his country, was justified with a familiar big lie. He was planning genocide against his own people. We knew that if we waited one more day, said President Obama, quote, Benghazi, a city the size of Charlotte, would suffer a massacre that would have reverberated across the region and stained the conscience of the world, end quote. This was the fabrication of Islamic militias facing defeat by Libyan government forces. They told Reuters there would be, quote, a real bloodbath, a massacre like we saw in Rwanda, end quote. Reported on March 14, 2011, the lie provided the first spark for NATO's inferno, described by David Cameron as, quote, a humanitarian intervention. Secretly supplied and trained by Britain's SAS, many of the so-called rebels would become ISIS, whose latest video offering shows the beheading of 21 Coptic Christian workers seized in Libya and were seized in the city that supposedly was liberated by NATO bombers. For Obama, Cameron, and Ulan, Gaddafi's true crime was Libya's economic independence, and he's declared intention of stop selling Africa's greatest oil reserves in U.S. dollars. The petrodollar is a pillar of American imperial power. Gaddafi audaciously planned to underwrite a common African currency backed by gold, establish an all-Africa bank, and promote economic union among all poor countries with prized resources. Whether or not this would have happened, the very notion was intolerable to the U.S. as it prepared to enter Africa and bribe African governments with military partnerships. Following NATO's attack, under cover of a Security Council resolution, Obama wrote to Chenyu, quote, confiscated $30 billion from Libya's central bank, which Gaddafi had earmarked for the establishment of an African central bank and the African gold-backed dinar currency, end quote. That's in Obama's own handwriting. Have you seen that in the New York Times? The so-called humanitarian war against Libya drew on a model close to Western liberals' hearts, especially in the media in 1999. Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, sent NATO to bomb Serbia because they lied. the Serbs were committing, quote, genocide against ethnic Albanians in the secessionist province of Kosovo. David Sheffer, U.S. Ambassador at Large for War Crimes, claimed that as many as, quote, 225,000 ethnic Albanian men aged 14 to 59 might have been murdered. Both Bill Clinton and Tony Blair evoked the Holocaust and, quote, the spirit of the Second World War, the West's heroic allies with the Kosovo Liberation Army. Do you know anything about the Kosovo Liberation Army? You should. They have an incredible criminal record. But all that was set aside. They were sanitized. They were whitewashed. The British Foreign Secretary, Robin Cook, told the KLA, this terrorist group, call me anytime. Here's my mobile phone number. With the NATO bombing over, and much of Serbia's infrastructure in ruins, along with schools, hospitals, monasteries, and the national TV station, international forensic teams descended upon Kosovo to exhume evidence of the Holocaust. The FBI failed to find a single mass grave and went home. The Spanish forensic team did the same, its leader angrily denouncing, quote, a semantic paraquat by the war propaganda machines. A year later, the United Nations Tribunal on Yugoslavia announced the final count of the dead in Kosovo, 2,788. This included combatants on both sides and Serbs and Roma murdered by the KLA. There was no genocide. The Holocaust was a lie. The NATO attack had been fraudulent. Behind the lie, there was serious purpose. Yugoslavia was a unique, independent, multi-ethnic federation that had stood as a political and economic bridge in the Cold War. Most of its utilities and major manufacturing was publicly owned. This was not acceptable to the expanding European community, especially newly unified Germany, which had begun a drive east to capture its natural market in the Yugoslav provinces of Croatia and Slovenia. By the time the Europeans met in 1991 to lay their plans for the disastrous Eurozone, a secret deal had been struck. Germany would recognize Croatia. Yugoslavia was doomed. In Washington, the U.S. saw that the struggling Yugoslavia economy was denied World Bank loans. NATO, then an almost defunct Cold War relic, was reinvented as imperial enforcer. At a 1999 Kosovo peace conference in France, the Serbs were subjugated to the enforcer's duplicitous tactics. The accord included a secret Annex B, which the U.S. delegation inserted in the last day. This demanded the military occupation of the whole Yugoslavia, a country with bitter memories of the Nazi occupation, and the implementation of a free market economy and the privatization of every single government asset would be privatized. No sovereign state signed on this. Punishment followed swiftly. NATO bombs fell on a defenseless country. It was the precursor to the catastrophe in Afghanistan and Iraq, Syria and Libya, and Ukraine. Since 1945, more than a third of the membership of the United Nations, 69 countries, have suffered some or all of the following at the hands of America's modern fascism. They have been invaded, their governments overthrown, their popular movements suppressed, their elections subverted, their people bombed, and their economy stripped of all protection, their society subjugated to a crippling siege known as sanctions. The British historian Mark Curtis estimates the death toll in the millions. In every case, a big lie was deployed. So that is but part of the article. The rest of the article you can listen to. Now, how many people are even aware of the real history of false flags, the Tonkin Gulf resolution that got us into Vietnam, which caused upwards of 3 million Vietnamese to die, hundreds of thousands to die from Agent Orange, and from birth defects since then, over 58,000 Americans, over 300,000 injured, and we never apologize. That does not include Laos. It does not include Cambodia, which also suffered, all based upon a lie. Now think of the other lies. Weapons of mass destruction, lies. The lie that a group of people masterminded 9/11, and now we know the truth, at least part of the truth, from the 28 redacted pages that the Saudi Arabian royal family, members of their government, were behind it, financed it, protected them, met with them in the United States, and facilitated their getting out of the country. We've been lied to nonstop. So what happens when you wake up one day and you realize you're voting as a Democrat because you want to see the first woman get elected president? Well, first of all, she's not the first woman to be nominated. There are other women, including Jill Stein, a real feminist who supports women's rights, not sweatshop rights of that are non-existent in for the making of most clothes made in Indonesia, China, and Bangladesh and India, but someone who cares. That's where the people should go at this moment. But remember, Hillary was behind much of what I just mentioned. And she has a very strong neoliberal agenda. No matter what she says, what she does is just the opposite. Here's one person that was very pro-Hillary Clinton. It's a very short piece. But she actually had the courage to look to see what exactly are you doing with my vote. She started with Barack Obama, but I can assure you she's not going to vote for Clinton. She trusted, like so many people, trusted Obama when he made all those statements, and then she found the truth.
But nothing invigorates and empowers.
No, we have a short clip by a woman who is going to tell you the truth about what she feels and what she did. Let's see if we have that ready. Oh, we don't have that? Then listen to this one. This is about false flags.
More than a spectacular act of violence, some sudden and senseless loss of life that allows the autocrat to stand on the smoking rubble and identify himself as the hero. It's at moments like this that the public, still in shock from the horror of the tragedy that has just unfolded before them, can be led into the most ruthless despotism. Despotism that now bears the mantle of security. Acts of terror and violence never benefit the average man or woman. They only ever benefit those in positions of power. This is why Nero fiddled while Rome burned. It gave him a chance to throw out the Christians to the lions and rebuild the capital of the Roman Empire in his own image. This is why Hearst and the warmongers of the emerging American Empire were delighted by the destruction of the USS Maine in Havana Harbor in 1898. It gave them the excuse they needed to rouse the public into supporting the Spanish-American War. This is why Israel attacked the USS Liberty in 1967 during the Six-Day War, strafing and torpedoing it relentlessly for hours in a vain attempt to send it to the bottom. The Israelis believed that the loss of the Liberty could be blamed on Egypt and draw the Americans into war. This is why there are hundreds of documented examples of government staging attacks in order to blame them on their political enemies. In every civilization, in every culture, in every historical period, authoritarians have known that spectacular acts of violence help to further consolidate their own power and control. And sadly, throughout history, there have been all too many willing to allow attacks to occur, to pretend that attacks have occurred, or even to attack their own population in order to further their political agenda. To think that such staged provocations and false flag attacks no longer occur would be as unrealistic as believing that human nature itself has changed, that powerful people no longer seek to increase their power, that influence is never used for deceit or manipulation, that lies are no longer told to satisfy greed or slake the thirst for control. It is to believe that our society is immune from those things that we have seen in every other society, in every other era. In short, it's a dangerous delusion. The people are once again learning the power of this delusion. They are learning the extent to which they have been lied to. They are once again studying their history. The Russians are learning how the FSB was caught planting bombs in Moscow in 1999 during a terror scare that swept Putin into power and stirred the public into supporting the Second Chechen War. They are learning how their autocratic ex-president came to power campaigning on the graves of those his old FSB cronies had killed. The Israelis are learning how Mossad has been caught time and again posing as the very Muslim terrorists they claim to be opposing. They are learning how Israel uses the specter of terror to further extend their blank check drawn on American funds to expand their police state at home and maintain their hardline stance, the world's sixth largest nuclear superpower supposedly threatened by the possibility that one of their neighbors may one day obtain a single nuclear weapon. The British are learning how their SAS officers were caught dressing up as Arabs in Iraq, driving around with trucks full of munitions, shooting at police to stir up ethnic tensions and ensure that permanent bases could be built in the region. They are learning how Harun Aswat, the supposed mastermind behind the 7/7 bombings, was working for British intelligence. They are learning how British military intelligence took part in IRA bombings. The Indians are learning how the Mumbai attack was helped by a U.S. agent who is cooperating with investigators so that he won't face questioning by foreign authorities. The Canadians are learning how their own provincial police dressed up as protesters in 2007 and threatened violence against other police in order to force a crackdown on peaceful protests. And the Americans. The Americans are learning that there were multiple bombs found, dismantled, and taken out of the Alfred P. Murrah building on April 19, 1995. They are learning that Timothy McVeigh had written a letter to his sister in which he claimed to be in the Special Forces for the U.S. Army. They are learning the bombing was being directed by FBI informants, just as the 1993 World Trade Center bombing was. They are learning about 9/11 and the Gulf of Tonkin and Operation Northwoods and their own Army counterinsurgency manuals that teach officers how to commit false flag attacks to blame on their enemies. In short, the people are learning the truth. And now we see the same build-up to a false flag event taking place that we saw in 1995. At that time, the U.S. had a corporate media desperate to fling mud at anyone concerned by the actions of their government, and it had a government that was desperately unpopular. Today, we see the exact same factors at play. If anything, the situation today is worse than it was in the run-up to the Oklahoma City bombing, with media consolidation meaning that groups of concerned citizens like the Oath Keepers are being attacked by the controlled minions on both the left and the right.
And that's just part of what he has to say. So, just keep in mind, almost all of our major regime changes have been preceded with massive demonization, and then it provides a justification for our entry, and then look at the mess we've made. Let's now go over to my guest who's standing by in Washington, D.C. Winona Halder, nice to have you with us today.
So glad to be with you.
Just thought I was going through my archives, old archives, before I put them in storage, and this is one I got. Dear Gary, thank you for having me back on your show. As always, it was a pleasure to speak with you. The response we have received has been truly remarkable. Our 800 number has been ringing off the hook. We have also received word that the Food Marketing Institute's toll-free number has been flooded with your listener calls. Your listeners have proven to be valuable activists. Again, thanks so much for your support. Michael Colby, Executive Director of your organization, Food and Water. And when was that? May 1st, 1966. 20 years ago.
Yes, well, Food and Water Watch is a different organization. We're about just about 11 years old.
Well, it was I didn't know that. I thought it was the same name. Anyhow, what I want to talk about today, what I'd like you to talk about, is begin by looking at fracking as a political issue. Now, Hillary Clinton's a large supporter of fracking, as is Barack Obama, who continues to allow public lands to be open to the fracking companies, and now recently has offered 1,500 offshore natural gas fracking permits. And Donald Trump has consistently supported fracking and claims that it would make America energy independent. Only Jill Stein is adamantly against fracking and has called for banning it. And we would like to think that fracking should be fading out. It hasn't reached its promises. Natural gas companies have filed bankruptcy. And more drills are inoperative and dry because the estimates for the size of gas reserves were off. Yet this industry persists. Why? So take us through what the problem is that we don't see an end to fracking.
Well, you know, I just wrote a book called Frackopoly, The Battle Over the Future Energy and the Environment, and I traced over the past 150 years how we've ended up here today. And it's basically because the oil and gas industry has become so entrenched. They've been allowed to get so large that they basically control energy policy and have for many decades. Many of the choices about how tax money is used for research, even the technologies that were developed in the late 1990s and are being used for fracking, were developed with our tax dollars. Many of the decisions made earlier in the 20th century about making oil, natural gas, fossil fuels, the energy choice, were because of the power of the oil and gas industry. And I think one of the exciting things that we've seen over the past about 7 or 8 years is the way that the activists, that the ban fracking movement has really begun to build some political power. Now, not enough yet to ban fracking everywhere, but we did begin to see what happened in New York when many, many groups came together under the rubric of New Yorkers Against Fracking and began to build the power, and Governor Cuomo did then actually ban fracking. We've seen moratorium in Maryland. We've seen more than 500 communities around the country take some kind of action against fracking. And of course, we've seen fracking become a major issue in the current political election.
Okay, we hear that many parts of the United States are already water-stressed, and this will only become more serious and severe in the future as climate change and global warming continue to increase. If every day natural gas drilling produces 10.5 billion gallons of toxic wastewater, then you can put this into perspective as to the future of safe and clean water for the nation in the future, including agriculture.
That is exactly right. And fracking takes 50 times more water than conventional drilling. So we're seeing as many as, on average, 1.7 million gallons used, and in some states like Texas, as much as 13 million gallons used. In Colorado, for instance, we have seen the fracking industry outbid agriculture for water. And it is true that many of the western states where fracking is taking place are water stressed. We've also seen in California something really outrageous, and that is that oil and gas wastewater, remember that it has a lot of toxic chemicals in, things like benzene, toluene, a whole host of toxic chemicals and hydrocarbons could be present in with this wastewater. It's being used to irrigate crops after a very rudimentary process to remove some of the contaminants. And what they do is they put the waste in walnut shells to remove some of the caustic chemicals. And I think this is pretty shocking. Even some organic brands are being grown using wastewater in Kern County and Coelho County in California, the Central Valley of California. So we're definitely in a crisis. It's time for a clean energy revolution. And we're pleased at Food and Water Watch to be one of the groups that is sponsoring a big march called the March for a Clean Energy Revolution in Philadelphia this weekend. On Saturday, there will be a summit about banning fracking and other extreme energy technologies, and then we're having the march on Sunday.
Well, give us your we're at the end of our program, so give us your site where people can go and get this information. Is it foodandwaterwatch.org?
Yes, foodandwaterwatch.org.
Good. That's this Saturday and Sunday, Philadelphia. Show up and march against hydrofracking and get a lot of information in the process. Thank you very much for all the good work that you're doing, Winona. We appreciate
it. Thank you so much for covering this.
Winona Halter, H-A-U-T-E-R. We're going to close today's show with that woman who decided she had had enough of not questioning the people in politics that she voted for.
Post on the internet, but I wasn't always. In 2008, I was actually one of your most hysterical supporters, as you might be able to tell from this shirt that's now vintage. It says that you're my homeboy. I waited for 3 hours in the rain to see Michelle and Stevie Wonder and Oprah campaign on your behalf. And this is me on the night that you were elected, shedding a tear of euphoria because I thought history had been made. But like a lot of Obama supporters, I sat back for the next couple years and figured I'd let you handle all that change because you're the one that was selling it anyway. And then when I decided that maybe I should like Google the news to see what was going on in the world, I found that you had become exactly like the George Bush that I used to so vitriolically hate. And now I know that your advisors don't always tell you about all the evil things that are going on in your administration because you're just too busy. At least that's what you tell the news. So I thought I'd give you a recap of all of the mayhem and crime that you've been committing. You bailed out bankers and placed them in your cabinet. You placed Monsanto in charge of your FDA. You helped out pharmaceutical and health insurance companies with Obamacare. You expanded Bush's wars and started new ones with drones, branding yourself a humanitarian warmonger. You bragged about crippling sanctions against Iran, though they directly affected civilians. You extended the Patriot Act and asserted your right to spy on the American people. You also asserted your right to detain them without trial. You even seized the authority to assassinate Americans without providing any evidence of their guilt or offering them due process of law. You viciously punish journalists and pursue whistleblowers who expose your crimes, though you vowed to protect them when you were running for office. You arm al-Qaeda insurgencies, refuse to close Guantanamo, and you, along with Congress, have criminalized protest. And still, you have the audacity to scold dictators about democracy, protest, and freedom. Mr. Obama, you are the biggest fraud that has ever been perpetrated on the American people, and it's been a long time since I bought into it. So I think it's about time to burn your shirt.
So that's just one person who decided to look at the facts and not just be absorbed by the image, an illusion. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day.